Same deal.
Welcome to the Diggin' Deep Podcast, the recently named inaugural Diggin' Deep Podcast. My name is Professor Rahul Deep Singh Gill of the Department of Religion at California Lutheran University. I have my man, Jose Marichal, here in the studio.
Yes, yes.
Slash office.
Yes, yes, the man. I like that. That was authoritative.
Dr. Jose Marichal, Associate Professor.
Get the name right.
Of political science.
Get the name right.
Am I missing a middle name?
Francisco.
JFM in the house.
Or Frank. I'm trying to kind of Anglo it up.
So, you don't usually do that. You don't usually Anglo things up.
I usually don't Anglo. Depends on the crowd. Some crowds you got to Anglo it up.
You're crowd specific.
You got to tailor your messages like a good political operative would.
Speaking of political.
Yeah.
Segue. I got a bunch of stuff to talk about today, and some of that includes politics.
Oh, it's a good thing you got a political scientist then to illuminate.
Dr. Marichal, I don't know if you know this, but there is a black man running for president this year.
What?
I think that might be unprecedented.
Dang.
Really? Did you know that?
You sure about that?
I think so. I'm pretty sure I saw that on the internet.
Yeah.
No, but in all seriousness,
you wouldn't know it.
You wouldn't know it, right?
You wouldn't know it.
Is race playing a role in this election?
I think so.
How so?
I don't know.
Really?
No, you know, is race playing a role in this election? Race plays a role in every election.
Right.
Every election. If you break down the voter demographics, you can get a lot of predictive power out of knowing an individual voter's race. So just by that alone, it's going to that has an impact. There's no way to know. You know, there's actually Jodi Kantor wrote a book about the Obamas, had an interesting article. I think it was in the New York Times where she was kind of talking about how the president has a very kind of tortured relationship with race, where he really tries to conceal it. And there are opportunities where he kind of, you know, where he kind of lets go a little bit, but for the most part, he's really trying to be restrained and muted about it.
Do you think that was sort of exacerbated, made worse once he took office? I mean, do you think the office of the presidency, is something that he doesn't want to kind of mix up with these racial issues?
Well, yes, but then, you know, the Jodi Kantor article, she really talks about how he understands the gravity of the role of being the first black president.
Mm.
That he takes very seriously the idea of sort of doing well and showing well for the race, you know. But at the same time, you know, what makes him so appealing to a lot of people is that essential multiculturalness. Thank you.
Multiculturality.
I thought being in this building would make me more...
You mean the
erudite.
Humanities building?
Yeah.
No, it's not really the erudite. I think there might be some mold in here. No, I'm just kidding. There's no mold in the humanities building.
I'll blame it on the mold then.
It's
that sort of that sense that he's of a group, but he's not completely defined by that group that resonates with people. I think it might resonate with you. It resonates with me, like this idea of like kind of straddling two worlds. You know, my parents are both immigrants from Cuba.
Right.
I grew up in a basically Anglo. I got to Anglo it up sometimes. That wasn't just for show.
That wasn't
you
just
know?
Frank.
Like, so Frank is sometimes you got to Frank it up.
You got to Frank it up.
But, you know, like it's that sense of like being able to straddle two worlds and trying always to sort of break out of the box so that you're not just being defined by your race, but your race isn't ignored. And you're always kind of you're in a double bind in that way.
Yeah.
Because I think, I don't know it for sure. I'm sure people can sort of criticize me, kind of get at me about this analysis, but it strikes me that, like, when he's attacked,
right,
it seems it's par for the course. But when he does the attacking, it looks a little unpresidential or strident. You know?
And do you think that's what happened in the first debate, is that he kind of went and took that anxiety about being portrayed as the angry black man?
I don't know.
Really hard?
I don't know. I really don't. I mean, how could you know, right? I mean, it could be that his campaign genuinely thought, look, let's just sit on the lead,
right?
You know, and let's not worry about...
Run the clock out.
Four corners.
Right.
And they used to do that in basketball. Did you know that? Are you old enough to know about four corners?
Yeah,
before shot clocks.
Drop some knowledge about the old
before
days.
Before the shot clock, you could just play four corners.
Yeah,
you could just put in, just like...
Right.
Yeah.
But it didn't work.
It didn't work. Now, you know, I think this is part of his demeanor, right? Like, he's from Hawaii. I mean, you know, you brought in a political scientist, not a psychologist, but his demeanor, right, is like Hawaii, you know, like laid back, cool. But he plays that up.
Come on, he's like such an intense dude, though. Like,
well, he's an intense dude, but that's part of his personality.
So it's kind of laid back intenseness.
Yeah.
And he turns it on. I mean, maybe he was just tired that night.
Could have been the altitude.
The altitude. Al Gore said.
Yeah, it could have been. Who knows, right? You know, my personal beef about all of this election stuff is that people always talk about that we analyze this stuff like a horse race, like if it were like, you know, punditry. It's all about punditry. It's all about image. And I'm like, that's fine.
Right.
If you're going to be a pundit, be a good pundit.
Right.
That the punditry sucks.
You think so?
It's awful.
What do you think is particularly?
I was thinking about this because I did this blog post about like how, you know, the traditional media sources are really even dropping the ball, like the PBS and Slate.
You did this blog post on the Thick Culture blog.
On the Thick Culture blog.
So people out there will Google Thick Culture.
Thick Culture. Society pages.
Society pages, and get on that blog. They will see this blog post.
Yes.
In which I argued
that even the elite media are getting into the horse race. But then one of my friends, collaborator on the blog, said, you know what? Football, sports gets better analysis than the political campaigns.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's exactly right.
Right.
It's not that it's punditry. It's that it's lazy punditry. Uh-huh. Right? Because if you remember, like, think about football, right? I don't know if they still do. I don't follow it as much as I used to. But they used to have, like, a show on ESPN where Ron Jaworski. Remember Ron Jaworski?
Yeah.
Played
Jaws.
For the Eagles. Jaws.
Jaws.
You know, him and I think like maybe Craig James, they would actually sit down and they would like break film down. And they'd be like, okay, see the defense, they're playing a playing a cover two.
That was like the professor's football.
Exactly.
Show. Yeah, yeah.
Right? You talked about strategy and tactics. You actually like took the time to sit down and watch film.
Right.
Right? You didn't lazily say, if an offensive line had completely got out of the way and the quarterback was under complete pressure, it'd be like, oh, that quarterback just couldn't get it done.
Right.
Right? Because that would be lazy, right?
Right.
Think back to here, right? Every time you see an analysis of these debates, it's all about, oh, the president was, you know, the president didn't answer back, or the president doesn't have a good answer for why the economy is as bad as it is.
That's really interesting. It seems like what you're saying is that, like,
they could learn from ESPN.
Well, the ESPN seems to probably have learned from the analytical mode of good news, doing good news.
Yeah.
And the news people seem to be watching ESPN and trying to make the news like ESPN.
Look, think about like intelligent people, and I'm talking about like, you know, the On Point, the NewsHour, all these PBS people, intelligent people sitting around going, oh yeah, the president, he talks about the economy being bad, but people are bored of that. Or Mitt Romney sure looked presidential, right? As if like whether or not the president could get something done or not, or whether or not, you know, Mitt Romney's flipping positions have nothing to do with Congress.
Right.
They don't have anything to do with political parties.
Right.
It's as if, like, we abolish parties, we abolish Congress, you know, and we're having an election for king of the world. That's what it feels like.
Right. But Brother Marischal, this is why we brought you on the show today.
Okay.
We want some expert punditry. If I gave you the ball, and said, you know, foreign policy debate last night, talk to me, Brother Marischal. Spit hot fire. What did you see?
Well, let me give you some punditry. Right? Let me give you some punditry.
Drop it.
Right? The reason this president is in the position he's in.
Which is what? Which position?
Well, bad economy.
Yeah.
Even a positive approval rating, but like the possibility of losing the election, although
tight,
I don't think
election.
It's going to happen.
Right.
Tight election.
Right.
Is because he has an opposition in Congress who employed a strategy that says we have enough votes to filibuster every major piece of legislation.
Right.
And we're going to do that. We're going to play the prevent defense. Or if you're into soccer, we're going to bunker in. Right.
Uh-huh.
We're going to put eight men behind the ball. Or we're going to play four corners.
Right.
Every minority party tries to do that.
This is a common tactic.
They may not abuse the filibuster rule the way that the Republicans are doing, but that's fine. Whatever. That's the tools you have.
But
every political party tries to do it.
But playing that blocking game is politics.
It's politics.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, nothing but love for it.
Right.
But you can only succeed at it if you have enough party discipline.
Right.
If every member in your party is rewarded by going along with the dictates of the leadership.
Yeah.
So the Republicans could hold 41 members in a coalition on every single policy issue because there are no moderates left in the Republican Senate. There are no moderates left. Mm-hmm. The few moderates that were around, like Dick Lugar in Indiana, got beaten by a conservative who said, compromise is when they come to me.
Yeah, compromises for the weak seems to be a motif out there.
So they have implemented a tactic that says we're gonna thwart the legislation of this guy. The only thing that, you know, what has the president been able to accomplish in 4 years? A 900, you know, a stimulus bill that, again, these pundits seem to have no interest in talking about, because you could have an interesting debate about what did the stimulus bill do.
You know what's interesting? I remember reading Paul Krugman back in the day going,
"This ain't enough.
This ain't enough. This is just not going to do it."
Yeah.
And, you know, but I feel like the Obama administration, I don't know, did they push as hard as they could have for $1 trillion-plus bill? Or
look, you know, political scientists don't put much stake in, like, talent, a president's ability.
Yeah.
You know, underlying dynamics matter a lot more. When you have 41 members, almost all of whom are from very conservative and very conservative positions.
Right.
If they move to the middle, they're going to get a challenge from the right. You're not going to have much compromise. There's not much room for compromise.
So those underlying elements were there certainly in domestic policy. But do you think in foreign policy, this guy was dunking on them, or like how would you look at his foreign policy? I mean, that's what the debate was about last night.
How do you look at his foreign policy?
I mean, should he just be going around every time, be like, "I killed Bin Laden. I killed Bin Laden."
Well, I mean, I think he, I think he sees himself as a pragmatist.
Yeah,
and he sees himself as the kind of guy who's a problem solver. That, like, he's going to sit down and he's going to sort of ingest all this different information, and he wants people in the room who disagree with him, and he's going to come up with, like, what he thinks is sort of, from a rational analysis, is the best sort of course of action.
So, you're talking about the level of the cabinet. Right, you're talking about
joint chiefs of staff, close advisors. He doesn't have a lot of close advisors, supposedly, that he relies on. So, yeah, my sense is that he looks at, well, if my job is to keep the country safe, then let's do drones. You know,
well with other rational actors in the room around him who he can bounce ideas off of, hear out.
Yeah,
right.
I think he's a hyper rational guy. Yeah.
But then how does that policy built from a hyper-rational guy do in sort of state actors that are working in their own best interests, or almost in some kind of non-rational ways, like a Russia? I mean, do you think this charge of leading from behind is true, or is it even a charge? I mean, is it kind of is it a good thing that he should be boasting that, hey, leading from behind, or should he call it something different? You know, it's actually the way to do it in the 21st century.
Well, he's an interesting guy because he's not of his time, right? He's not a media soundbite kind of a dude. I mean, I think he really is the kind of guy who likes to be deliberative. You know, he likes to sort of take the measure of an issue.
Yeah.
And so leading from behind, in a lot of ways, I think he came in, his political training is Chicago, and he brought Rahm Emanuel in, and he figured, you know, his way of doing it is to, like, you know, don't attach yourself to anything. Don't let the opposition sort of be able to, like, sort of stick anything to you. Let it get worked out in Congress and come in at the end of the process and then attach yourself to it.
Yeah.
So that's what he did with the Affordable Care Act, right? That's what he did with Obamacare. It wasn't Obamacare until he came in and signed the law. Then it became Obamacare, right? That's more like, let's make deals. That's Chicago style deal making.
Is that what that is?
Let's make deals. Let's get things done.
Deal. He's not getting his hands dirty there. He doesn't seem to like getting his hands dirty.
Rahm Emanuel's getting his hands dirty. You know, the chief of staff is getting his hands dirty. So that was like, let's cut deals. I think he thought, look, I'm going to do Yes We Can. And this is probably the reason I supported him, right? It's like, I'm going to do Yes We Can. You are the change you've been waiting for. But at the end of the day, I'm a pragmatist. I'm, you know, Chicago is my political education. I'm going to cut deals. I'm going to get messy legislation done that's going to be centrist enough for everybody to, like, you know, for everybody to be okay with it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be known as a can-do, get it done, bridge the gap, because that's my temperament. That's my makeup. And that just hasn't been the case before. When he got there, you know, I think the conservatives rightly said, we don't got to deal with this guy.
Yeah.
Let's just sort of lock it down. And they did, right? And he thought, oh, we'll cut deals. They were like, we're not cutting deals. You can give us everything you want We're not going to cut a deal because we know that the public is going to like give you the credit for passing. So just like they gave Clinton credit.
Is there any way to play offense against that defense? I mean, there's got to be holes in that defense. No, I mean, can't you? I don't know. People talk about political pain. How do you show a party that's running that prevent defense political pain? I mean, was his messaging just bad? And
I think the messaging. I mean, I think that has a lot to do with it. But like I said, political scientists don't put too much stock in it. What does a president have? I mean, a president has, like, you know, this is 40-year-old Richard Neustadt wrote about this. The power of the president is the power to persuade.
Yeah.
You know, now, there are other powers, right? I mean, you know, but the main power is the bully pulpit. Right?
I mean, you ever see The Godfather? Godfather 2? With the...
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. The senator? No, the senator. Michael Corleone knew how to push senators around.
Yeah, he could have just gone up to individual members.
Yeah,
and,
horse
heads. Put a horse head in their
horse
bed.
Heads in bed.
Lyndon Johnson
on.
Calling meetings, taking a dump and having meetings while
Chris Rock, you know, the public intellectual Rock, yes. Has gone on record and said that Obama would be a gangsta second term president. You think there's going to be heads in beds in second term Obama? Is our heads going to roll if he gets a second term?
Heads in bed work when members.
What did
let me tell you something.
I don't
heads
know
in bed work.
I'm going to have to edit this.
Oh, you're
podcast.
The one who did the head in bed thing.
Oh,
heads in bed
right.
Work.
Okay.
When the person who is receiving the head actually has some incentive to be scared, right?
I think
you can't
just lost
actually kill. You can't actually kill.
All right, time out. What you're saying?
You can't whack them.
Yeah, but how do you set up an incentive system though? If he gets a second term, right?
Well, name one member of the Senate that it would be afraid of like a reprisal from the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Who's vulnerable? From the left.
So it's...
There's no Republican that's vulnerable from the left. Maybe Susan Collins, but she's almost retiring.
But if we continue down this argument that you're making, the second term's not going to look much better than the first term in terms of...
Well, I think the second term's going to look worse.
Yeah.
The second term will not be worse in that at least the president will be able to, like, lock down what he's accomplished. And, you know, progressives, God bless them... But man, they are a whiny bunch.
Yeah.
Right? Because what did progressives? Oh, he hasn't done enough. Okay, well, universal health care, everybody's covered. Been trying to deal with this for 75 years. It was messy. It was ugly. It was that sort of like Frankenstein legislation, but it got done. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
An Affordable Care Act a stimulus that people, like, oh, it wasn't enough. Okay, fine. What did he invest in? Wind and solar and race to the top, education reform, like real education reform, privatization of medical records to like make the healthcare system more efficient.
So you look
high speed rail, internet access to rural areas, like infrastructure. Yeah. Aside from like regular run of the mill roads and bridges, that was progressive legislation.
You look down at that checklist and you see a lot of check marks. Let me flip the script on you now. You ready for this?
Flip it.
President Romney.
Yeah.
First 100 days of the Romney administration.
Right.
What happens? Go.
The Democrats try to do what the Republicans did. The Democrats don't have as much unity.
Right.
They're not as unified a party, so mm-hmm. you're going to get defectors because you have John Tester. If he holds on, John Tester's governor? Oh gosh, I'm trying to think of. Ooh.
Just make it up. I'll edit it.
No. Let me think. Hold on. Gosh, sounding all
some dude,
sounding all intellectual and whatnot. Let me think here. Members in the Senate from
the Missouri seat. Claire McCaskill.
Claire McCaskill is hitting right. Carnahan wrong. Uh-huh. Claire McCaskill, right? Claire McCaskill is going to hold on because she's running against a moron, right?
Yeah, who really?
But Claire McCaskill is in a massively conservative state.
And he's going to vote.
So Claire McCaskill is going to have significant incentives to, like, move with the Republicans on issues, right? Because that's, you know, she's in a state where she needs to do that for political survival.
So is that, right? So, I mean, that just comes down to, this is a sort of a red country with a few blue...
It's not a red country. It's a polarized country.
Right.
Where the Republicans are more polarized than the Democrats. Where they're both... the country's not polarized... Congress is polarized, and party identifiers are polarized. So people who identify as Republican and people who identify as Democrat or conservative or liberal are much more... Republicans are much more conservative. Democrats are much more liberal. Most people are in the middle, don't care one way or the other, or yeah. are in the middle, but they're not driving the train right now.
Yeah.
So the thing is, with the Democrats may want to hold, you know, do the same thing, and if they have enough seats, they can certainly hold it.
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't think Romney's going to get much more done, and he may not even have, even if he wanted to be a centrist, he's dealing with a very conservative Senate that is not going to, you know, go to the middle very easily. He's got, think about the people that are coming up next term, and actually these guys, Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein of Brookings, that just came out with this really great book that kind of lays this stuff out. Lindsey Graham.
Speaking of great books, I got another segue for you, but finish this point.
All right. Lindsey Graham.
Yeah.
Right, South Carolina. John Cornyn, Texas.
Yeah.
Right. These dudes, who's the one in Alabama? Is it Richard Shelby or not Richard Shelby? These two guys,
yeah.
right?
They're coming up after
those guys are coming up 2014.
Right.
Those guys are in conservative, anti-Obama states.
And they're going to have something to prove.
They are going to get challenged from the right.
Yeah.
If they even blink.
Right.
Even if they blink at moving to the middle, they're going to get challenged from the right.
So
they want to show what good base conservatives they are.
Polarization. I heard you're on the Facebook. Are you on the Facebook?
I'm on the Facebook.
I heard you wrote a book about Facebook.
Wrote a book about the Facebook.
When's that dropping? Is the album dropped?
It's dropped.
Is it gone platinum?
It's moving up the charts.
Yeah.
It's number 19 million on Amazon.com.
You check in every day? refresh.
It's number one on political books about Facebook written by professors in Southern California.
Dr. Jose Marichal, does Facebook make us better citizens? You're giving this talk tomorrow night at Cal Lutheran based on your book. You've asked here a yes or no question, so answer it in a yes or no. Does Facebook make us better citizens?
Well, who's going to go to the talk if I answer the question for you?
That's right.
What's that about?
All right, so tease us. What Facebook, does it matter? I mean, is this new politics, old means, or old means new?
Well, I don't know. What does it do? Okay, so I think like the big argument that I try to put out there
about
that,
social media.
Yeah, is that social media is part of a long term trend towards personalization of public life.
That's heavy, man. You have to break that down to English.
Hey, man, you know y'all just because
poor brother,
y'all in this building aren't the only people who like drop heavy stuff.
That's heavy. That's heavier than I can.
Oh, so, I gotta like actually like.
Yeah,
make
you're gonna
sense.
Have to. Yeah.
Oh, all right. So, you know, if we differentiate between public sphere and private sphere, or public life and private life, the public life is messy, contentious, about discourse, deliberation, optimally deliberation, but at least discourse, hearing the other side, disagreeing with the other side, maybe hearing the other side, completely ignoring them, doing whatever you want to do, but at least sort of understanding that there's another side
yeah.
that you have to compromise with, that you have to engage with.
There's an other you got to tend to. I mean,
there's an other.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Private life is not about that. Private life is about the language. It's not about the language of deliberation. It's not about the language of dialogue. It's about the language of disclosure for connection.
And when you say private life, you mean you're sort of engagements that you have.
Your engagement intimate. With your intimate family
right.
and friends and
mm-hmm.
sort of this smaller circle.
Yeah.
You know, Facebook takes that language of intimacy and connection, and that's how they sell themselves. It's all about personal connection.
Yeah. Your closest 3,000 friends.
Yeah.
You and your
And
closest
I, you know,
3,000.
Like, I mean, it's true that, like, you know, that I was just preparing the talk, like, the average Facebook friend, Facebook user has 190 friends.
Yeah.
But those are not all friends.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's still a network of intimates and semi-intimates.
Right.
That when we're talking to our friends and kind of our semi-friends, we're trying to disconnect with them.
Yeah.
And that means talking about feelings, about how we affect, about how we feel about things, about our deeper secrets. They're not subject for debate.
Yeah.
When I'm trying to connect with you about stuff, I'm not necessarily looking for like a debate about healthcare.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe intellectuals connect that way, but most people don't connect that way.
But even intellectuals, I mean, you get on there.
No,
at
right.
At the end of the day... you know, or between classes, you know, even dudes like us, if we're on Facebook, we're looking for, you know, Ken Meat Eats Cheeseburger or whatever, you
well,
know
yeah,
what I mean?
Sort of,
like,
right? I mean,
some mindless,
and even if
non-political crap.
Yeah, and even if I came in here and started talking about, like, you know, showing you that, like, Obama's birth certificate was a fraud and he's really a secret, you know, jihadi who's trying to destroy me, you'd be like, okay, all right, interview's over.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not what private life is about. I mean, right. Public life is about. Public life, that's not what private life is about. Private life is about intimate disclosure, and intimate disclosure is about affect. It's about how we feel about things. Public life is also a little bit about how we feel about things, but it's also a lot about the things themselves. It's also a lot about, like, how do we sort of get together to come up with some way of going forward on large-scale policy
issues. Give me an example of an issue that you've done an analysis on.
So what did I do with the analysis? I mean, the book was, like, basically looking at political Facebook groups and expecting that people were going to...
250. That's a lot.
That's right.
Yeah. But you're thorough.
That's right. I'm thorough.
Yeah.
I don't mail it in.
I know.
So... looking at these groups and trying to figure out, like, what are these groups about? Like, when people create a political Facebook group, what do they do it for? And I thought, well, it's for mobilization. It's to get people jazzed up, to get them to engage in public life.
Yeah.
Because even mobilization is engaging in public life, because it at least acknowledges that there's another that you have to mobilize against.
Yeah.
That's not what these groups are for.
What are they for, then?
The groups were for proclaiming your political identity.
To whom?
To whoever wants to listen, or nobody.
To the public, or to the
everybody,
private,
or to nobody.
The intimates?
To everybody or to nobody. And like, so the argument is about that Facebook is about emphasizing the language of affect, the language of the private, the language of disclosure and connection. And that's, and when we take that and we try to talk politically, then we talk about it more in terms of performing political identity, about disclosing our political self rather than this sort of, like, dialogue and this deliberation about that exists in public life. So an example is some woman who, like, created a website, a Facebook group about, like, being in solidarity with a bunch of kids who wore American flag shirts on Cinco de Mayo and got kicked out of their school.
Yeah.
Right? And that was the website. I stand with these kids. Mm. Right? And there wasn't anybody, if you stand with me, let's get together on this date and let's go protest. No, it was just to say, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore.
Does that expend energy that could otherwise be going into protesting? I mean, is it kind of a negative effect then? If people are going on Facebook, they feel like they're doing their job by standing with these people on Facebook, and then they don't go out into public and have more interactive discourse.
I don't know about that. That's Evgeny Morozov's argument in the Net Delusion, his book. The Net Delusion.
Should we buy that one?
You should buy that one.
We should buy yours first.
Definitely. Buy my first.
Yeah. What's the name of the book again?
Facebook Democracy.
Facebook Democracy.
Look at you, man.
Yeah. Palgrave. No.
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 Come on, man. Ashgate.
Ashgate!
How are you going to call it Palgrave?
My bad.
Yeah, that's like, they don't like those British publishers. They don't like you messing them up.
There is some beef between those two presses, between those two studios. But no, performing political identity, right?
Yeah.
You know what's really awkward is that, like, you know, people... Like, you know, your uncles start Facebook friending you and stuff, and then you'll post something as a joke, or they'll post something as a joke, and, you know, it'll be, like, the most derogatory, insulting thing, and then you're in this bind of, like...
Ignore it.
What am I supposed to do?
You ignore it.
But people don't.
Well, some don't, but most do.
But that's what it's interesting, right? Yeah. Like the family feuds that pop up on Facebook people are performing these identities.
I haven't analyzed it, actually, somebody was just telling me that Pew did a study that said that there's a pretty big chunk of people in the population who just ignore or unfriend or people who engage in too much politics on Facebook.
Oh, I see.
Because that's what Facebook is for, right?
Yeah.
Facebook isn't for discussing politics. You know, there's old maxim, you know, and you don't talk religion and politics in mixed company, right?
Or on Facebook. But not just discussing politics. Like, they'll put something on, like, as a joke that'll be extremely offensive, and then you're sort of in this bind of, like,
I think most people ignore it. Now, you know what happens is that, like, two or three people comment on it, and they go back and forth, and then it all fizzles out.
But did you know what I just did?
No, what'd you do?
I gave you an idea for your next book. Family feuds on Facebook. It's even alliterative.
FFFF.
Yeah.
FFF.
Look, the good people at home have been listening to this podcast for a while, but before we go, I need you to tell me do some future predicting for me.
Yeah.
All right. Michigan, California World Series, San Francisco, Detroit. Who you like?
Baseball?
Yeah, that's the sport I was referring to.
You want me to, like, make a prediction on baseball?
Yeah. Well, what did you think I was going to talk to you about?
I don't know, man.
The presidential race or some crap?
Yeah, baseball.
Now, have you watched any of this baseball?
No.
All right, I'm going to put you down as voting against Detroit. So that puts you down with Romney, okay?
No, man, you can talk soccer, you can talk basketball, you can talk football.
All right, basketball, the NBA season's coming up. Heat repeat?
Reheat? I think, sadly.
Reheat and serve?
I think, sadly.
Like a stale dinner or leftovers?
No, I don't think so.
Reheat.
I think, sadly, I think it's coming back to the Magic City. What's LA? Are they the Magic City?
I thought that was Orlando.
The City of Angels. No, you're right. The Magic City is Orlando. What's the City of Angels? I think it's coming back to the City of Angels.
Oh, you think so? And you're a Miami guy.
I am a Miami guy.
You're a Miami guy.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah. And this actually last debate was in Florida.
Yes, in Lynn College. I got my master's in Boca.
At Boca de Beppo, right?
Yeah, Boca de Beppo. They changed the name of it.
Isn't that where it was?
Boca de Beppo.
Last night?
Yeah. You know, people might be listening and have no idea what you're talking about.
Where was the debate?
Boca Raton.
Oh, Boca Raton, my bad.
Boca de Beppo. Boca de Beppo is an Italian restaurant in Southern California. It's a chain.
All right, last Miami
Immigrant thing. Dining. That's what they advertise themselves.
Last Miami thing. Because you are a proud Cuban American.
I am. I used to like baseball, but that was in the 80s. That's why I don't know anything about it now.
But come on, Ozzie Guillen. He just got fired.
Who knew? I didn't know. Since when were you such a big baseball fan?
No, I'm just. Look, man, I didn't know this interview was going to be interesting, so I actually came up
with... You have, like, filler? This is your filler? What are you, like, what is this, Conan? David Letterman?
Hey, the people got to keep coming back. Right. And that's it for today, but I hope people come back next time. Right. And will you come back?
I don't know.
Will you?
If you keep talking baseball, I mean, it was like baseball tonight.
I'm gonna go on Wikipedia and learn something about soccer.
I'll come back.
And we'll talk La Furia Roja.
La Furia Roja.
Yeah.
España.
Yeah.
Hostias, tío.
That's your people. That's your team, right?
That's my. That's part of my bloodline.
All right, I'll Google them.
No, I'm a U.S. No, I'm not. I'm an American. I'm a U.S. national team fan. Oh, all
right. Except.
Go look up Clint Dempsey.
Except there's that flag on your car for the Spanish national team.
Well, I don't have a Spanish national team.
Okay. No. All right, you must be some
other Clint Dempsey. Tottenham. Spurs. Go on, you Spurs.
All right. Peace out, everybody.